Okay, we're going to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. The time is 9 o'clock. Today is March 4th, 2013. And with us is Co-Chair Kelly, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, and Vice Chair Fairclough. So we have the full committee with us this morning. And today we're going to continue our work on the on Senate Bill 21, the governor's oil tax bill. We're fortunate today to have both of our consultants that are working for the legislature, Roger Marks as well as PFC. So I think let's start with, if there's nothing else come before the committee, let's go ahead and get started with Mr. Marks. Mr. Marks, if you want to join us. And with that, the floor is yours, Mr. Marks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Roger Marks. I'm an independent consultant in Anchorage under contract to LBNA. I think some of you know me and some of you do not. Just to briefly go over my background, since 2008, I've had my own private consulting practice in Anchorage, specializing in petroleum economics and petroleum taxation. My clients have included the legislature, the federal government, the University of Alaska, local municipalities, independent oil and gas explorers and producers, and pipeline companies. Specific work I've done for the legislature: in 2009, I worked on the Cook Inlet Recovery Act. 2010, I worked on the oil gas decoupling bill. And 2011, I worked on the oil production tax bill. Prior to that, for 25 years between 1983 and 2008, I was a senior petroleum economist with the Department of Revenue Tax Division, and in that time had a role in the statutory and regulatory design of the production tax. And as in most bureaucracies, sometimes that role was big and sometimes it was small. And sometimes it entailed plotting what was going on, or sometimes shaking your head in disbelief what was going on. And in addition to the work on the production tax, I also spent a lot of that time working on North Slope gas commercialization. So I've been asked for the committee to evaluate the current CS that's before you. And I'll just start out by saying that CS is a good piece of work, and as we go through this, I'll explain why it is a good piece of work in terms of what the challenges are for trying to make for a better production tax. And simply what I'm going to offer as I go through this are some observations about the CS and introduce some other possible approaches for the committee to consider. So the basic approach I'm going to take for evaluating the CS is the basic foundation is that there's an interest in evaluating the production tax at this time over concerns that there's slow investment and declining production levels going on in the North Slope since the enactment of the current production tax ACEs in 2007. And as background, Mr. Meyer from PFC, I believe, is going to go through this afternoon. I think Mr. Pulliam has gone through this with you prior, but you know, the very high level of the international investment climate is characterized by plenty of opportunities, fluid capital, but finite capital, and so investors allocate their productive resources to their most highly valued use. Taxes are a significant part of the cost structure, and under ACEs, they are relatively high, especially at current prices and at higher prices. And the proposition, I guess, going forward, which I'll go into as we proceed here, that the tax rates under ACEs have made Alaska uncompetitive, and the goal here is to come up with a more competitive tax structure. So that's the basic premise on which I reviewed the CS.
Okay, Mr. Marks, too, I failed to mention Senator Giesel's with us again, and of course this is the bill that came, the bill before us is the bill that came from her committee, the Resource Committee. And also, too, I want to thank Paul Quinnell for donuts. His phone went off Friday afternoon, so there is donuts in my office if anyone is hungry, although we don't want you to eat them in the committee room itself. Okay, sorry for that.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I've received a phone call on my cell phone since 2009, so I think I'm probably pretty safe here. So if we think about what taxes are, they're the price an oil producer or an oil company pays for an opportunity to develop the oil in a certain jurisdiction. And in many ways, it's a market with the buyer and the seller being the sovereign jurisdictions that are selling opportunities to develop, and the buyers are the oil companies. And again, the tax is the price they pay. And we think about we want to get a fair share for Alaska's oil through the taxation, and I'm going to define fair share as what you can get in a competitive environment. And at a very simple level, what is sort of going on is like if you're a baker in a town and you're selling bread for $5 a loaf and everyone else is selling bread for $3 a loaf, and you're not selling very much bread, and you're trying to figure out why. So where we're at now is, you know, we're selling bread for $5 a loaf, and we're trying to figure out just why we're not selling it and what we need to sell it at in order to sell more bread. So in order to think about how to make ourselves competitive, there's three main steps we need to go through. And one is determine who the competition is, and then determine where Alaska should be within that competition, and then design a system to achieve that target. And that's what I'm going to go through. So that's the basic paradigm I'm going to use to evaluate the CS along those lines. So the first, determining who Alaska is competing with, it's well known and well demonstrated that oil companies are willing to pay more in taxes where the reward is greater. In places where there's more reserves or less risk or lower costs, they will pay more. And when there's less reserves and less oil and higher costs, they'll pay less. And there's other factors that get into that as well. There's the political climate, there's fiscal risk, there's political risk, there's how educated the workforce is, the issue of whether you can get contracts enforced in court. So there are a number of issues. And we are not competing with, for instance, Kazakhstan, that has much more oil than us at much lower costs and much lower risk. On the other hand, we're not competing with Ireland either. The joke is the most favorable oil tax terms on the planet are in Ireland. However, there's no oil there. So we're in looking at the competition, you need to look at places with a similar risk-reward balance. And that's what we call the peer group. What are we really comparing ourselves with as a gauge to see what we want our tax terms to be? And what the peer group is, it's a matter of judgment. There are many factors that get into it, but you have to come to terms with who we're competing with. And I've established a peer group that I believe sets out who really we're competing with worldwide on a risk-reward balance. And there are four factors I use to come up with this. One is geography. I looked at Canadian provinces and U.S. states that produce more than 200,000 barrels a day. Second, I looked at the institutional environment. And these were jurisdictions that administer their fiscal system by taxes and royalties. They have competitive bidding systems toward leases. And they're the basic Western industrialized democracies. Three, I looked at the operating environment. And for these, I looked at other Arctic regimes. And four, I looked at geologic potential. And what I use as a proxy for geologic potential were jurisdictions that had similar reserves and similar and producing a similar amount of oil. Now, right now, Alaska produces North Slope about 550,000 barrels a day. And reserves on the North Slope are about 4 billion barrels. So what I did was look at regimes that produce between 400 and 800,000 barrels a day, and with reserves between 2 and 6 billion barrels. So you put all those together, I came up with 17 regimes that I considered those the peer group, and you can see them up on the slide there. And this graph rank orders those different regimes from low government take to high government take. Government take is the primary metric I'm going to use to compare these systems, and government take, again, being how much the government gets, and that means all taxes and royalties, both state and federal, as a percentage of the net value of the oil before tax. And as you see from this, at current prices, about $110 a barrel under ACES for currently producing fields, the take is about 74%, and that's pretty high on this peer group. Of that 74%, about half of it is the production tax, the other half being royalties, property taxes, and state and corporate income tax. So, you know, half of that is the production tax. It's a big chunk. Of that 74%, about 70% of that is the state share. The other 30% is the federal government. Now, if I were looking at this graph, and I were to try and decide what do I think a competitive target would be at $110 a barrel, I would say about 62%. So that, as I look at the world, then going forward, and for this analysis, I'm using a 62% as a target rate at $110 a barrel to judge the competitiveness of the tax. Now, again, this is a matter of judgment, just who we're competing with, and just where you want to, be in here within the peer group. But that's sort of how I am going forward here. This shows at $70 how the peer groups line up. ACES is 68%, and again, if I were looking at this, I would say about 65% at $70 would be a good target government take to be competitive. And this shows $160 a barrel. ACES is 77%, again, very high. Again, if I were looking at this, again, I would say about 62% at $160, the same as $110. So in summarizing, as I go forward here, I would propose a government take, starting at 65%, about $70, and then leveling out to about 62% at $110 a barrel and beyond. This would be a fairly neutral system, a fairly flat tax. Now, as I go through this presentation, I'm going to be using the terms regressive system, progressive system, and neutral system quite a bit. What a regressive system is where the government take is high at low prices and low at high prices. And those are very problematic because what you have is a misalignment of interests. You have when somebody's happy, somebody's unhappy, and that can cause things to happen that you don't want to happen. A progressive system is where the take is low at low prices and high at high prices, and that creates a more aligned setup of interests. And then there's neutral systems where the government take is pretty flat across the spectrum of prices. And neutral systems are a good alignment. What you have is where both people are either unhappy at the same time or happy at the same time, so there's no incentive for one party to try to make the other party unhappy for any reason. So that, again, is my take on where I would suggest the committee think about landing. Again, Mr. Meyer may have different ideas, or Mr. Pulliam and Econ 1 may have different ideas, but this is sort of my perspective, how I've come at it. But the point is, I guess, wherever the committee goes, I think it's necessary to think about a target, where you want to land up, where you want to end up with your tax system. The other thing to recognize, if you think, 64%, 62%, 65%, what difference, a few percentage points, do they really matter? And the answer is yes, they do. Each percentage point is actually worth quite a bit of money. And I've just showed here at current prices of $110 a barrel. Again, for the existing fields, the total, transportation costs and upstream capital and operating costs are about $29, which gives you an $81 per barrel net. And so if you multiply that by the taxable percentage or the non-royalty percentage and multiply that about 200 million barrels a year, each percentage point is worth about $142 million. And then if we go up back to, say, slide five, you know, if you look at Oklahoma, for instance, at 64% compared to ACES at 74%, that's 10 percentage points at $142 million per percentage point. So in Oklahoma, the you know, producers or taxpayers can walk away with $1.4 billion a year more than they can here. So that's why, number one, that illustrates, again, the problem with ACES at high prices, or current prices and high prices. And again, it also, you know, underscores why, you know, each percentage points matter. Now, in trying to hit these targets we're talking about, what makes it difficult to hit the target at low prices are a series of regressive elements that are in the fiscal system. And again, what we mean by regressive is it's high fiscal take at low prices. And so where you have and the problem with these regressive elements is number one, they make for challenging economics at low prices, particularly for high cost fields. But they also make it a challenge to design a production tax system to sort of offset their effects to get the take down, because the take, again, it's given, say, a 65% target at low prices, even if there's zero tax, because of especially the royalty, you get high take. And so it becomes a challenge in designing a tax to deal with these regressive elements at low prices and high costs. And the main regressive elements in the system are the royalty, the production tax, and the minimum tax. The royalty we're going to talk about in detail. That's the most significant one. The property tax right now, it's a little under $2 a barrel. And it's based on the value of the property. And so the way it's regressive is if something costs more, not only does it cost more, but your property tax is higher because it's valued more. And that creates kind of a double whammy, so it's regressive. The minimum tax in the code is the minimum of the tax you get calculating it on net value, and the tax or 4% of gross. And as we're going to talk about, any tax based on gross is regressive because it doesn't recognize the upstream costs.
Mr. Marks, we're going to do a brief Eddie's here. We're back. Mr. Marks?
So what makes a challenge to design a tax system that deals with these regressive elements? You can't just, the way the tax works is based on a company's total costs over the entire North Slope, and you can't design a system to say, well, if your costs are this much, here's your tax, or if your costs are that much, that your tax. You have to have a single system that applies uniformly to all costs. We're not suggesting at all that we get rid of the royalty and property tax or minimum tax. You just need to address them. Now, both the governor's bill and the CS did some very innovative things to deal with that issue, which we'll talk about. Now, going forward, we need to recognize that on the North Slope, there's a huge spectrum of costs up there. And we need to analyze how the tax system works at all these costs. The currently producing fields, fairly relatively low costs. The numbers I got for the Department of Revenue for calendar year 2011 was $7 a barrel capital and 13 operating for $20. Medium cost fields, which would entail some new production from existing fields, would be about $20 capital, 17 operating, total 37. And there's high cost fields, and this would be, you know, new development from new fields and some of the heavy and viscous oil. And that would be, I've estimated $33 capital and $21 operating, a total of 54. So that's the spectrum of costs we need to deal with, and the system needs to work for all those costs. And just to illustrate what the royalty does and why, and sort of what the tax needs to try to overcome at low prices to deal with the regressivity of royalty, this is just a calculation of the regressivity of the royalty at low prices and high costs. So let's say we have an ANS market price of $70 a barrel. and your transportation cost, that would be the pipeline cost and marine shipping, are $9. And that gives you what's called the gross value. That would be $61. And then if you subtract the upstream capital and operating costs, so let's say this is a high-cost regime, $50, it gives you a net value of $11 a barrel. But the royalty is based on one-eighth of the gross. So one-eighth of the $61 is $7.63. So the royalty, so out of $11 of pre-tax profit you have, the royalty comes in and takes $7.63 of that, you know, 70% of it, before any property tax, production tax, or income tax. So it creates a problem at low costs and at low prices and high costs for the taxpayers. And this is sort of an example of how the effect of the royalty is different depending on whether you have a high-cost field or a low-cost field. Now, that the blue dotted line across the top shows the gross value. As ANS market price goes from $70 to $200, again, you subtract about $9 for marine shipping and pipeline, so that gives you a gross spectrum of from 60 to 190. And for the low-cost fields, we said they were about $20 a barrel. The green dotted line there shows the net for low-cost. And if you're $50 a barrel, we see the net for the high-cost fields. And then the bottom line shows the royalty. And again, the thing to understand is the royalty is the same for both, whether it's low-cost or high-cost. So if you have a high-cost field, if you go to the bottom corner there, where the bottom dotted line and the blue royalty line come together, the royalty is chewing up just about literally 100% of all your net income. And as you get to higher prices, it's less of an issue, but at low prices, it's a problem. So here are the basic features the CS had. The 35% tax rate that applies to the net value, or the term the tax code uses is production tax value, and that's the market price less all downstream and upstream costs. And there was a 30% gross revenue exclusion, or GRE, and that's used to compute the net value. Once you determine your gross, you take 30% off that, and then you subtract the upstream costs from that. And then there's a $5 a barrel credit that's credited from the tax as well. The other provision that's not as important, but I'll just mention it, is if the production tax value or net value is negative, that loss can be carried forward to that point in time to when it's positive and it's credited at 35% of the loss. And this is a provision that allows taxpayers to realize the benefit of deductions if they fit the tax floor of zero. Currently, you can take that credit in the year it's incurred. What the CS proposes is that you have to defer that credit with interest until that time that you have positive income. But the thing to realize about all these features is they work together. At the end of the day, you're going to get one tax, and you know, I think some people have been focusing on, you know, this for instance, the gross revenue exclusion is going to be a big negative on tax revenue, but you realize, you know, the tax rate has gone up. And so these things are a package. They work together, and you need to realize the net tax after they all work together is what people should really focus on. So how these features operate, and I'm going to, again, a lot of these features, the GRE and this $5 barrel credit, again, which were quite innovative and clever features that the governor's bill and the CS had to deal with these issues of low prices, I refer to them as sort of royalty offset features to deal with the problem of low costs and high prices. So what the CS did is increase the gross revenue exclusion from 20% to 30%, and these only basically apply to new fields or new participating areas of current fields. And what they do what it does basically, it brings down the tax rate more for high cost fields and brings it down more at lower prices. And then a feature that was introduced in the CES was a $5 a barrel credit. Again, that also helped to bring down the tax rate for high cost fields at low prices as well. Then to offset these features, again, these all work together as a package. To offset those, the tax rate was increased from 25% to 35%. And what that did was that mainly worked at the higher prices to offset the effect of the gross revenue exclusion, how that at high prices. Now, the tax code's a little bit complex about how all these features operate together. And I've tried here to put together kind of a traffic map of how they interact. So what the taxpayer does when they're figuring out their tax liability, they figure out two ways. One, the net approach. You know, you subtract all your costs, they get down the net and apply the GRE and the $5 credit and the 35% tax rate. Or you calculate at 4% of gross calculation, and the tax is the higher of that. The 4% is considered the minimum tax. On each of those, there's a floor of zero. The gross revenue exclusion, you use that when you do the net calculation. You don't use it when you use the minimum tax calculation. The loss carryforward credit is applicable regardless of whether you're calculating on net or the gross minimum. And the $5 barrel credit is also applicable if you're calculating either on the net or the gross minimum basis. The $5 credit in the lingo of the tax code is called a non-transferable credit, which are in section 024 of the code. And what it means, non-transferable generally means if you can only bring your tax rate down to zero. Once you hit zero, if you have unused portions of those features, you lose them. You don't get to you only get to use it to the point where it gets your tax down to zero and no more. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. So this is the government take under the CS, again, this creates a much more competitive regime than what we have under ACES. It's done a good job of flattening out the taxes on the low sides for high cost fields. And yet, the other thing I should mention when we go through these graphs and looking at, you know, the spectrum of $70 to $200, we should not underappreciate the role that low tax scenarios play in corporate planning. You know, nobody knows what oil prices are going to be. The corporations realize that probably more than anybody. They've been burned many times before by assuming prices are going to be higher than what they were, and prices come down. So when they're planning, they look at how their projects worked over a spectrum of prices, and they include, you know, everything from $70 to $200, maybe even lower, maybe even higher. And what they also do is what they call stress tests. They want to make sure, even if they don't have a spectacular rate of return, they want to make sure that at least they don't lose money at low prices, just as a safety check. So in reviewing the CS, I want to focus on two things here. One is how these government takes relate to a target, and two, how these takes relate to each other, how these takes at the different costs relate to each other. So in terms of the first...
Yeah, I'm sorry. Senator Hoffman.
Can we get... in the past, we've received several reiterations of the tables. Can we get the government take in dollars and as well what it is to the state treasury? And I don't know if you're going to go into it, but on these same scales, what the industry will be taking in dollars.
Yeah, Mr. Marks, is that something you can do?
I do that real quick. Yep. I mean, not right here, but tonight I could turn that around quite easy.
That'd be great. Thank you. Is there any other questions here while we have a break? Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, since you said I was a break to do this, ask the question. You mentioned something about when the companies, just a line or two ago, companies are formulating their investment policy. Is there any information or data on some of the other oil patch places we're looking at that the number of times one changes their policy, how that impacts the investment climate? In other words, it's Texas. We're looking at outfits like Texas and Norway and Alberta. In the past 10, 15, 20 years, how many times have they changed their tax policy?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, answer your first question. Fiscal stability is very important because knowing what's going to happen obviously is important in planning. And so fiscal stability, you know, when we talk about risk-reward balance in certain jurisdictions, that's one element that gets into it, is how stable the regime is. To the best of my recollection, Texas, for instance, I don't believe has had a material change in their fiscal structure in the last 10 years. In terms of all these places, Britain has changed it, but Norway, I mean, for instance, their current structure has been in place since 1994. I could be happy to go back and try to get a general assessment on just, and do this within the peer group, how the frequency in which fiscal terms have changed.
You know, Mr. Marks, I think that's fine. You don't need to get us an answer on that yet. We can do some research tonight. But I think maybe PFC may have that information as well. So that question may get answered this afternoon. Senator Fairclough, that's what you were going to say?
Mr. Chairman, I just was going to say that we have someone who I think can answer that question.
Okay. Very good. If there's no other questions, please proceed.
Okay, so in addressing the first issue of how these fiscal takes relate to a target, you know, I frankly don't know whether the Resource Committee had a target in mind or not when they developed the CS. And I'll just mention that, you know, given again this 62% target that I mentioned, you know, for the low cost fields, it's 5 percentage points above the target. And 2 percentage points below. But the other thing I want to sort of dwell on a little bit more is this issue of how these fiscal takes relate to each other, the difference between the low cost and the high cost fields and how the difference is in the take. And it's about 7 percentage points here after you get beyond about $110 a barrel, and want to sort of focus on a couple of things to think about in terms of having different takes for different cost structures. What I want to suggest is, given a target price, again, or a target take at a given price, and again, let's think about 62%, I would suggest the system should come as close as possible to hitting that target over a spectrum of prices. And the reason is because that's what the competition is. And so a tax regime, I think it would be useful if the tax terms should apply to all structures similarly or as close as possible. And the other issue is the issue of explicitly treating different fields differently, specifically the provision of not having the gross revenue exclusion apply to existing production. You know, both existing and new production benefit from existing and new investments. And the existing fields contain a lot of costly targets in the existing participating areas that, as I understand, the CS would be excluded from the gross revenue exclusion. In Prudhoe Bay, in the IPA, the participating area we have now, and in Kaparik, and in Milne Point and Alpine, and all these fields, there are certain what we call isolated fault blocks or stratigraphic traps. They're just pockets where They're part of the same reservoir, but the communication is very poor. And the only way to get those, to get that oil, and there are lots of these targets in those fields, possibly even hundreds. There's extensive literature on it. And the only way to get those targets is to explicitly drill them. And the drilling for that would not be real cheap. In addition, you know, when we talk about an efficient tax system is when the highest valued resources get produced. And you don't want to have the tax system distort that. And when you have a system that favors, it has lower tax rates for certain places over others, there's a danger that this differential tax treatment could cause unwanted shifts in investment. And a great example about this was the ELF system we had in place between 1978 and 2006. In 1989, the ELF was changed so that big fields had high tax rates and low fields had low tax rates. And immediately after that, there was a huge shift of investment from the high tax fields to the low tax fields. And what happened is production declined on the high tax fields and production increased on the low tax fields. But the production decline on the high tax fields caused on net a total production decline for the slope. And so the issue to be concerned about is if you have different tax rates for different fields, are you going to cause an unwanted shift in investment? So that would be something to think about going forward.
Mr. Chairman.
Mayor Hoffman.
That was early on, but later on in ELF, did not the tax rates shift downward drastically for Kuparuk?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, you are exactly correct. And Kuparuk was a very strange field. And what happened at Kuparuk, if we look at like the last 10 years of ELF, say between 1996 and 2006, in 1996, Kuparuk had a fairly high ELF. And the way the tax rate worked is it was based on both average well productivity and field size. And it gave you 300 barrels a day tax-free, and if you produce less than 300 barrels a day tax-free, you paid no tax. Well, Kuparuk's average well productivity was not that much more than 300, and you got in a situation at Kuparuk that the economics at Kuparuk were such that if you did anything to increase production, let me pause say and believe that the ELF was a seriously dysfunctional system. But what happened, the way Kuparuk worked is, in those last years, if you made an investment to increase production, the way it worked, it would increase production on every single barrel on the field. And so if you looked at the marginal economics, how that increase in tax over every single barrel in the field attributed to the new barrels, those new barrels had an incredibly high tax rate and very poor economics. But what you're saying is true. As a result of that, Kuparuk's production declined to where the average well productivity dipped below 300, and so it basically had no tax.
How many years did they have no tax, and did that stimulate investment?
Well, to answer your first question first, it wouldn't stimulate investment because if they invested, it would increase the tax on every other barrel. And the marginal tax on increased production would have been exorbitant the way the ELF worked. I think the last year of ELF, it was near zero for maybe 4 or 5 years before ELF finally went away when the PPT came in, but it may have been exactly zero or very, very close to zero the last year or two.
And can you explain to the committee why you believe there were no investments, even though Kuparuk is the second largest field on the North Slope and no investments occurred?
Well, again, during the ELF era, prices were much lower than they were today. Again, over the last 10 years of ELF, they were, in the $20 range and escalated up to about $60. Again, the reason I believe, you know, no investments occurred in Kaparik in the latter years of ELF was the way that tax structure worked, that if you produce new barrels, you increase the tax rate on every single barrel in the field. But incrementally, if you look at that increased tax attributable to the new barrels you get, the tax rate was very, very high and the economics very, very poor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Hoffman. Okay. Please continue, Mr. Marks.
So now I want to offer some specific comments on the features that were used, the gross revenue exclusion, the $5 barrel credit, to try and bring the tax rate down at low prices and high cost fields. Again, if we go back to slide 13, again we see what I call the royalty distortion. It's just how much the royalty chews up of the net value at low prices. You see it's different, it's a different effect for different costs. It's much more serious for high cost fields and less serious for low cost fields. So what the gross revenue exclusion and this $5 barrel credit, you'll note they're the same for all cost structures. Again, since they're based on gross, whether you have a low cost field or a high cost field, the gross revenue exclusion is going to be the same, and $5 is $5 regardless of your costs. And so they're unconnected to the actual production costs. Because of this, they have different effects at low prices depending on the cost structure. Again, if we go back to slide 17, we see, you know, there's different, it gives you a different take whether you have, you know, medium cost fields or low cost fields or high cost fields. And that's because these features don't recognize, you know, again, are unconnected to the actual production costs. Also, they're unaffected by investment. You know, if you invest more, if you invest less, it's not going to affect, you know, the gross revenue exclusion or the credit. And on another feature, another aspect of the $5 credit I'll mention too is again, it's one of these we call a non-transferable credit. If you get down to the zero tax floor, either under the net or the gross, portions of that $5 credit that you haven't used, you lose it. You don't get to pick it up again. Now, what in terms of other things to think about, what I'd want to talk about now is the $20 capital credit that was under current law, under 023A, that was revoked in the governor's bill and stayed revoked in the CS. And how that works is for capital costs, the $20 a barrel credit that you get at when the cost is incurred. And if you have a negative tax or you go down to the floor, you can convert that tax to a credit and the state would buy it from you. And so how this $20 capital credit, this 20% capital credit compares to these other two features, it's explicitly related to the actual costs. It's whatever cost you get, that 20% of that is the credit. And so there's an automatic, what it provides is an automatic adjustment mechanism to different cost structures. If you have low costs, the credit is low. If you have high costs, the credit is high. And that works to offset this royalty distortion, which is high for high cost fields and low for low cost fields. And again, the capital credit is affected by investment. If you can actually reduce your taxes by investing, so it's an incentive to invest. And it's what we call, again, a transferable tax credit under the lingo of the code, which means you still get to enjoy the benefit even if you've hit the zero four of the tax. And since you get that credit at the time the cost is incurred, it provides a boost to the net present value and the rate of return. So what I'm just simply suggesting is that the committee may want to think about retaining this credit as you go forward. Now, I do understand that there is some concern about the cash flow that's been experienced over these credits, also the exploration credits as well. You know, when in tax administration, people are always concerned about any credit because there's always the concern, they would have done it anyway. And that's always enters into any kind of credit you have, and it's something to be concerned about. And I understand there's also some concern that some of these credits are used for certain kind of maintenance expenditures that aren't really conducive to getting more barrels, which is what you really want. So going forward, you may want to think about, you know, focused or targeted capital credits, for instance, towards simply well drilling. Right now in the code under 023, I believe it's L, M, and N, there's a 40% capital credit for wells for areas south of the North Slope, and so the language is already written. It's in the code. I would not recommend the 40%. I would say if you go that way to keep it at 20, just because of the gold plating concerns when you get much above 20%.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Huffman.
You know, in this recommendation that he's making, this year has a price tag of close to $1 billion. So, you know, that is I think that is one of the reasons that the legislation excluded it, to move it forward to reduce the taxes. And to already, you know, I think that the way that the legislation is working, when we take a look at the operating costs for the state of Alaska in the next 10 years, we're going to see some major problems. And if we accepted this recommendation, we'd see even more complications in meeting the state's obligations. But that's take his recommendation under advisement.
I think Senator Hoffman, and I appreciate your recommendation, Mr. Marks. I mean, that's what we're here for, is look at all different ideas and hopefully ultimately find the sweet spot, the one that increases investment and then maximizes our return. But I think the difference between Senator Hoffman, our current capital credits don't target production. And what Mr. Marks is suggesting is that you would only get the capital credits if you drilled wells, and you're not going to drill wells unless you're going to produce. So we would need to look at the numbers to see what the potential impact could be to the state. And I guess I would like to see if capital credits, well, I think you are saying are probably better than the GRE. But I'm interested in that idea because I'd heard in Norway they have what's called uplift credits to, again, try to get more of that harder oil that's in the legacy fields that cost more. I think that's what you're saying these capital credits would be, is similar to an uplift credit. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. And Senator Fairclough, and then we'll let you respond, Mr. Marks. Senator Fairclough?
Mr. Chairman, asked a question a while ago, or I asked a question in the Resource Committee about hearing from the Department of Revenue and separating out gas credits that are a potential liability in Alaska's future if Point Thompson came online versus oil credits. So we've been given a scenario, as Senator Hoffman alludes to, that in future years Alaska could be faced with some pretty stiff credits, but we really don't know if those are coming from oil or gas at this point in time. And so I would just ask if PFC Energy, Mr. Janik, would respond to this later this afternoon, the same question. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Marks? Senator Hoffman, yes.
One other comment. You know, Mr. Chairman, you talk about we're trying to target more production, but you can't get more production unless you have exploration. And we can encourage exploration, but the success of those exploratory wells has no guarantee that we're going to find oil and lead to production. In fact, the odds are against onshore, against more production, even if we find 50% of the wells. And I understand that is the numbers are a lot lower than that. So although we may want more production, we need to look at how we're going to encourage more exploration, with no guarantees that we will come to production.
Yeah, and Senator Hoffman, I don't disagree with you, but I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Mr. Marks, but I think The majority of the oil that we know of is in the legacy fields. It's just harder to get to. So if you're targeting wells in the legacy fields, theoretically that should lead to more production. But I don't disagree that we also need the exploration as well. Senator Faircliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to dovetail on your comments. I think that that it depends on which stream of revenue we're looking at. If we're looking at immediate investment or immediate return on Alaska's dollars on those investments, that if we look reflectively at what Prudhoe Bay and our large fields have produced, the recovery rate for that originally was in the 30-35% range. We're pushing 60% recovery inside those wells, and what at least the producers and the partners inside the legacy fields are saying is if they had the state as a partner in recovering more, they could produce more out of those existing. So I think Senator Hoffman is correct that long term we're looking at, or even mid to long term, that more exploration will put more oil in the pipe from new pools of oil. But that if we're looking in the short term, say the 3 to 10 year cycle, then those legacy fields are still Alaska's best opportunity to put more in the oil in the pipe more immediately. So it's a different philosophy, hard sometimes to believe in if we don't feel like we've seen it under the existing tax regime. But I really like the Kaparik conversation, because I didn't know that the government itself had put a limit in, and the taxing regime responded differently than those lawmakers thought. They thought the 300-barrel limit was a way to help those smaller fields, and in the end it helped Kaparik stay small instead of coming up over. If they would have bracketed that, then Kaparik would have seen more investment, because every barrel of oil, like progressivity, wouldn't have reached back and been taxed at that higher rate. So I appreciate that conversation.
Very good. Senator Dunleavy?
Just a quick question. We're studying a lot of math. We're looking at a lot of models, et cetera. But you said something earlier that, I'm going to paraphrase, but in the end, it comes down to psychology. In other words, that the companies have to feel that if they're going to invest in something, they're going to get a return. Has there been any study or any thought or any discussion as to how, and I know we're supposed to keep these separate, but they just keep bumping into each other, but how one's fiscal or spending policies at a state level, how those spending policies affect investment? In other words, let's say as we go through this this concept of a tax restructuring, and things look good and there comes to some consensus or agreement that this is the way to go, if a state's spending policies are such that it appears that they're always waiting to take a bigger chunk, does that enter into the investment psychology of a corporation?
Now, through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, yes, I think the situation you have in Alaska is you have 90% of the general fund revenues coming from one source, and I think there is a concern that if things turn south, do you come to the industry for more? And having a diversified tax base, which Alaska does not have, but would allay those concerns. But that's an issue. That is an issue in terms of the political economic climate in Alaska.
Just a very a quick follow-up. Venezuela is considered a petrostate, and they rely on 70% from petroleum, where we're 90. So we're getting into the realm of the ultimate petrostate without a diversified economy. If, again, our spending policies or the psychology behind our spending policies are such that we're just waiting for the next bump up, waiting for the next chance to wait for that investment to go in and then jump on the only major economic producer in the state, if we don't deal with this on this side, but we just isolate the tax policy on this side, are we missing a huge chunk of the psychology that may come to haunt us down the road? If, for example, if we go through this process and everything looks good on paper for taxes, and for some reason there's no investment, is there no investment because, we knew all along they were pulling our chain, or is there no investment because in the boardrooms they may be talking about us waiting to change the tax policy again once there's more production?
If you pass the perfect tax, and there's not an investment response. There's a number of reasons, you know, why that could be. And I mean, one of the reasons is the reason you said. And I mean, it could be other reasons, you know, how they look at the geology, even though geologists tell us there's plenty of oil there. In a few slides, I'm going to talk about the issue of progressivity. And I'll bring it up now because I think it's an issue. And, you know, right now, you know, the CS has taken progressivity off the table. And I think, you know, again, if you pass the perfect tax without progressivity, you know, if oil prices go up to $200 next year, you don't want to find yourself back here. And you may have to if that happens. At the same time, you know, if you just look around the state and you know, in terms of how many people think the current tax is fine and how many think the current tax is not fine, it's a little bit fragile. And you could imagine, again, you pass what you think is the perfect tax based on what you think, and you know, very small shifts in the political climate could change things. One thing, you know, progressivity would do is if prices go up, everyone understands what the deal is. And without something like that in place, you know, it could give investors pause because it just creates a lot of uncertainty, and corporations hate uncertainty. They, you know, a lot of times you'll see, you know, after a large legal judgment against a company, for instance, you know, billions of dollars, your stock will go up because people know what has happened, and so the uncertainty is away. I'll talk about progressivity, but I think it's and the corporations too. I don't know, you know, some of the corporations would prefer. I don't know if any of the, you know, people in this room or who are going to testify, you know, later this week, what would say that, but definitely around the world, you have situations where particularly where you have production sharing contracts in more volatile countries where producers want to negotiate a progressive system just because, again, if prices go up to $200, they know they're at risk of expropriation or, you know, nationalizing of their assets. But in many ways, corporations look at large tax increases as very similar to a confiscation of assets as well. So I mentioned that as one thing. I mean, there are pros and cons of progressivity, which I'll get to, but it's, again, it's one thing the committee may want to think about going forward for that reason.
Okay. I still want to get your response on the targeted capital credits versus the GRE and how we could limit the hit to the state treasurer, because obviously we are looking at a $900 million capital credit, as Senator Hoffman said, without the effect that we were hoping, which is more production. But let me just keep that in mind. Let me. Okay. Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. Okay. Mr. Marks?
Should I address that question now, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman?
Please.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I think the question was, you know, which is better, a targeted capital tax credit where you might maybe targeting wells in a legacy field that helps uplift some of the hard-to-get oil, versus the GRE that we're currently considering?
Mr. Chairman, given those features, I would definitely recommend the targeted tax credits as being preferable, because one, they provide incentive to invest. They're directly, the amount of the credit is directly related to the cost itself, where the GRE is what it is regardless of what the costs are. And then, you know, whether, again, there's no such thing as a perfect credit. You'll get situations where they would have done it anyway, but if the concern is that the credits now are being used for things that don't produce oil, like maintenance, even though those are indirectly necessary, but if you want to target them for activity that's more directly related to producing oil, it would be vast improvement over no credit, and I believe a more effective mechanism for getting more oil than the gross revenue exclusion.
Okay. Well, very good. We'll have to run the numbers on that and see which looks better. Okay. Yes.
Senator Olson.
Senator Olson, yes. Sorry. Senior moment there.
Sorry. Mr. Marks, I was just wondering, does Norway have a GRE type of element to their tax structure?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, they do not. They basically have a net. It's basically their whole tax. They don't even have a royalty. That's one reason. If you look on those charts, where they have a higher take than we do, because producers are much more protected on the low side in Norway than they are here. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, we'll let you continue, Mr. Merkel.
Okay, so what I'm going to talk about a few alternative tax structures to look at. But before I do that, there's two other detailed outcomes of the CS I just want to show folks. One, again, with a $5 credit, it's what they call a non-transferable credit. Once your tax floor goes down to zero, you don't get to use it. And I just sort of show here for different cost fields how much of that credit actually gets used. And for instance, both for the low-cost fields get the $5 credit at all prices because they don't hit the floor. But for the medium-cost fields up to about $90, they get less than the whole $5 because they're hitting the floor before then. And for the low-cost fields, they wouldn't get the whole $5 credit until prices are even higher than they are today because of the tax floor. The other thing I want to show is just a cash flow comparison. Again, you have to look at all these things as a package and how they work together. And without focusing on one, the cash flow aspect of one versus the other, but what I did here was simply for medium cost fields, look at the cash flow, what the GRE and the $5 credit together are worth as opposed to a $20 capital credit. And the $20 capital credit is the same, it's a little under $5 regardless of what the price is because it's based on spending. But the GRE and the $5 credit is quite a bit higher than the credit. At current prices of $110, it's about $15 a barrel, obviously $5 for the $5 credit and $10 for the GRE. So in terms of, focusing on the cash flow of the capital credit, the negative of the cash flow of the capital credit, here's just sort of how that lines up with the cash flow of those other features as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
And again, can we get what it will cost the state treasury for both of these schedules on 20 and 21 so we can see what we're talking about in total dollars?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I will do that. So I want to look at now, if we have a goal of a 62%, a target, a 62% take, and we want to have similar tax rates for, across the whole spectrum of costs, I've just for illustrative purposes, I've put together sort of four different approaches to do that. And the first is just using the features of the CS. But what I've done is I have a 30% GRE applying to all fields, not just the new fields. And I've increased the tax rate from 35% to 40%. And you could see how the curves come out. The rates come together at high prices. They're close to the target. It gets the high cost down at low prices. You're still above the target at low prices for higher costs. And you're still, you still have different, at low prices, you still have different rates as well for different costs. So that's one approach. Another approach is again use the 20% capital credit, and then to get the 62% target, I put in a 23% rate. And so this has, without a GRE, without the $5 credit, a 20% capital credit and a 23% rate. Again, this is illustrative. But as you can see, it brings down the low and mid-cost mid-cost fields at low prices, and it brings the low and the mid-cost to the target at fairly low prices. You know, it still has high costs for the high-cost field. It has high costs at low prices and above the target. However, you know, we should recognize that you know, for high-cost fields at prices about $80 a barrel are probably low probability scenarios anyway. So probably shouldn't obsess too much about what happens to the high cost fields at low prices, because there are other factors that would probably keep those from being produced anyway. But this curve here lines up all the costs at a fairly low price at $80 as opposed to $110 in the previous slide. And the reason, you know, it does all these things is the credit is directly related to the actual cost, as opposed to how the GRE and the $5 credit were you know, unconnected from the actual cost. And again, the credit provides those other, the capital credit provides those other good things like encouraging investment and increasing net present value and rate of return. Now, here's a third way. If you wanted to bring in all the features, bring in a capital credit as well as a GRE and a barrel credit. Now, what this is a 26% rate, a 20% capital credit, a 5% GRE in all fields, and a $2 a barrel credit. So what it just shows, you can use all these features and try and craft something that gets a, you know, a flat curve with all the costs together at a certain target. Now, you notice with this curve and the curve I had for the capital credit before, that as you get to higher prices, there's a slow downward slant to the takes, you know, at high prices. And the GRE, that's because the GRE, you know, was eliminated in the prior one or is low on this. The GRE, the royalty still has an effect even at high costs. And what the GRE was able to do was sort of offset that and levelize the curve at higher prices instead of having this slow downward shift. But there's another way without the GRE you could structure to affect the shape of this curve, and that's with a progressivity structure. A progressivity structure, you can use that to do two different things. One, again, we talked about a progressive system with low takes at low prices and high takes at high prices. But you can use a progressivity structure to actually create a neutral system to just affect the shape of the curve, or you could go further to actually have a progressive system and make it low at one end and high at the other. And so we talked about progressivity a few minutes ago. You know, the basic, you know, pros and cons of progressivity, like everything else, if it's not excessive, it can protect the producer's interest at low cost and protect the state's interest at high costs. And again, it may be necessary for fiscal stability, which I discussed before. On the con side, you know, a progressivity system only works if you're balancing the low side and the upside. You can't have you need to have a low take on the low end and you know, to offset the high take on the high end. And with these inherent regressive elements in the system, it may be difficult to achieve that. I also mentioned that many of the jurisdictions in the peer group I mentioned do not have progressivity. Most of them have royalties or neutral systems. And so in terms of the peer group, progressivity is not there. Probably the biggest reason to consider a progressive system would be this fiscal stability concern.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
I guess, can we, all of the ones that have government take for benchmarking, can we get these same schedules with the current law so we are looking at, so we can get a comparison? I think it would be excellent for the committee to see where we are currently and what is being proposed by each one of these scenarios.
Mr. Marks, is that possible?
So, Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, as I understand the question, you want to see the government takes for the other jurisdictions as well?
No, just Alaska's current law.
Okay.
So we can see where we are today and if these were adopted by the legislature or where we'd be. So
I did
give us a benchmark.
Senator Hoffman, but those earlier slides did show it's 70-110,
right.
but I'll show them for the whole.
Each one of these schedules so we can show where we would potentially be going.
Senator Bishop.
Senator Hoffman, to Roger, did I hear you want to see ACEs overlaid?
Yeah, just to where
oh, yeah. Okay.
So here, what I put together, again, is I guess for illustrative purposes, what's called a bracketed progressivity system. If you think about having a progressivity structure, I would highly recommend you don't use the progressivity structure that's in ACES. The way the ACES progressivity structure works is as your price goes up, you drag up the tax on every single dollar of value before it. Under a bracketed system, you pay only incremental tax on incremental value. And this, again, this illustrative example system, I start out with the lowest bracket of a 20% rate going up to $60 net, and then a series of brackets that ends up at a 50% rate at $160 net. And I've included the 20% credit, and this just shows you what you get with that. And then to close out, Mr. Chairman, I just want to discuss two other technical issues in the CS just to bring to the attention of the committee. And under Section 10 of the bill, as I mentioned before, the loss carry forward credit is deferred until the company has positive income. Who would be, and it's deferred with interest, and so most entities will not be affected by that in terms of long-term cash flow, but this would affect if you're an explorer out there without any other nexus in the state and you don't find oil and never have any positive income, you would never get to enjoy the benefit of the deduction for the cost. And so this provision may discourage new entrants. The other provision I just want to mention is Section 25. What that does is eliminate the loss carry-forward credit for exploration expenses. Now, what this would do, if you're right now under the law, if you're an explorer with no offsetting income, you can still realize the benefit of the deduction. Let me step back a second. Right now, if you're an explorer producer, you're producing oil and you're an explorer, and you have income where you can offset your exploration expense, you get the benefit of the deduction. Of the expiration expense. Now, again, normally the loss carryforward credit is a way for people to enjoy the benefit of the deduction if they don't have offsetting income. So under this provision, explorers with offsetting income, because they have other production, can get the benefit of the deduction, and those without offsetting income would not get that benefit. And so this could be considered disparate treatment between two different sets of interests. The other thing I'll mention about this provision, and the best way to explain it is just to provide an example. If you're a producer with $100 in gross value, and your exploration expenses are $90 and non-exploration expenses are $80, if you deduct your exploration expenses first, you'll have $10, and then you can deduct it to $80 from that. From the $10 you have left, and so you would have $70 in loss carryforward expenses you could use because they came from non-exploration expenses. But if you subtract the non-exploration costs first, then you wouldn't be able to use So then you wouldn't be able to get the loss carry-forward credit and enjoy the benefit of deduction for the exploration expenses. So the bottom line is the order in which you subtract costs would matter in terms of whether you could actually realize the benefit of the deduction for exploration expense under this scenario. So you may want to address the order in which you subtract costs in enacting this provision. And that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any other questions if there are some.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Marks. And Mr. Marks, you did it. You did exactly what I was hoping you would do, and that is to present some other thoughts, ideas, alternatives. I think the governor's bill was a good start. I think the resource committee embellished it, made it even better. But there, you know. We're hopefully going to find the best, and so I appreciate you presenting some new ideas for the committee to look at, and obviously the what the cost is to the state will be a big factor in our decision. The capital cost credits have become very expensive to us, as we found out under ACES, and haven't given us the results that we had hoped they would. So that's probably the only hesitation you're going to see from us on going or continuing with a capital cost credit. But as mentioned, if it's targeted and to wells, and we have defined what a well is in statute, I think it's got potential, especially in the legacy fields. Any other questions, comments by committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, I sure hope this request isn't a burden, but I'm left with a, I guess, an itch I need to scratch. Is there any way, either through Mr. Marks or DOR, to get a list of the countries and states that we're comparing tax structures with, but also to find out just what the diversification of their economies are, how much they rely on oil as a percent of their government revenues? If they have an income tax, would also be helpful for me. So, for example, Norway has more money in their permanent fund than we do. They retain an income tax, and I need to go on the record, I'm not advocating for income tax. I'm just trying to find out all of the psychology that goes into the potential of an investor looking at a place to invest. Because what I'm concerned about is Alaska is not diversified. 90% of our income comes from oil, and our discussions are really about two entities dancing in a relationship. How much are they going to take from me, and how much are they going to take from me? It's our oil, it's our investment, et cetera, et cetera. So I just need to understand this mix when we look at the whole picture, if through the chair that request can be put together by DOR or somebody.
Yeah, I think we'll make that request of DOR. You bring some good points, too. There's other factors involved that we can't control. I mean, the location of the state and being so far from the market, transportation costs, weather costs, permitting, and those things that also play into making Alaska not as competitive as, say, as a state like Oklahoma or Texas, even Canada to some extent. And as my co-chair here said, you know, we don't want to be competitive. We want to be attractive. Additional questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marks, as we talked about the 20% capital credit that was there, and then Senator Hoffman talked about the $1 billion hit we're going to take as part of the state. Are those numbers indeed true?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, you know, DOR has those numbers. They know exactly. I mean, some of those credits are exploration, and some of those are capital. And so it'd be you know, important to keep those distinguished from each other to understand, because they're quite different.
Would you say they're approximately true then?
Yeah, here's
what my real question has to do. You don't like GREs. What kind? Or let's assume that they are true or approximately true. And you don't like GREs. What's your recommendation for us to go ahead and try and rectify the deficit that we'd be seeing in our state's budget here in the next several years? Do you have a suggestion that we have where there's a compromise between the capital credit, 20% or otherwise, and the GRE that you don't like, what suggestion do you have to go ahead and help us fill the gap?
Well, through the chair, Senator Olson, it's not I don't like the GRE. GRE is a very good innovative device to deal with the issues of designing attacks. But just sort of, again, the GRE involves cash flow out too. I mean, so it's just, you need to look at all these features together as a whole. What you don't know, people are disappointed with the amount of production going on with the capital credit. Couple things. Number one, you don't know how much less activity there would have been without the credit, and I'm sure it's responsible for some. But number two, the whole issue you had overhanging these credits was the huge tax, that because of ACEs you pay for any oil you discover. And so the idea here is you get a competitive tax in place and get more, and again, if you get more focused credits that only apply to activities that produce oil, incentivize that activity with the credit, and it would be sort of the state's participation in developing the oil as a partner with the industry.
So you don't have a suggestion that we may look at to try and rectify the deficit?
Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, through the chair, the best way to deal with the deficit is to have a competitive tax system, and I believe the oil is there. I think Mr. Pulliam laid that out the other day. There's something like, the USGS says there's something like 10 billion barrels of oil sitting in the core developed area of the slope between the existing fields and heavy oil and oil to be discovered through exploration. And so,
thank you.
You know what?
That's my question.
Okay, very good. Any additional questions, Senator Bishop?
Just a comment. I just want to make sure I'm hearing correctly. Senator Dunleavy alluded to a little earlier, how do we've been doing this dance since 1977, trying to hit the sweet spot on taxes, and historically you can go back and look. We've changed our tax rate about every 7 years. There's been one time where our tax has stayed in place for 13 years. And the easy oil is gone. We produce 16 billion barrels. Now we're looking at that 3.5 to 6 to 10 billion that's left of the easier oil, okay? So as we go forward, trying to get that stability on this harder to get oil, I just want to make sure that we get it right. And so to summarize what you said, I'm hearing what you're saying on progressivity. Maybe we should take a look at this progressivity in the way you've got it bracketed here is maybe getting there so we get a little bit more on the higher end, so we're not, if we don't have the progressivity, if I'm hearing what you're saying, that if oil does spike, then we'll be back down here wanting to have a do-over again at $200 a barrel.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I believe that risk is there.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Okay, well, that concludes this morning discussion. Thank you, Mr. Marks. Very informative, very enlightening presentation. We do have floor session today at 10:45, so we're going to go ahead and conclude for this morning. We will have Mayor. Okay, we'll have Janik Mayer here this afternoon, who is our consultant that's been with us for some time. Helped us last year or last several years, and so we're glad that they're. back and helping us again this year. And he's got a presentation that he'll share with us this afternoon. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll conclude until one, or we'll recess, I'm sorry, recess until 1:30 this afternoon.